Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation with the Land of Israel Network. I am sitting with Michelle Baruch, who is also a tour guide, but she has a specialty, and that has to do with water, and it's called Israel Water Tours. So, Michelle, thanks so much for joining me today. We're sitting here at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, just having a cup of coffee together and talking about Israel and the things that we love the most. So thanks for being with me here today.
My pleasure, Eve.
So tell me, what is your background? How, you know, a lot of the tour guides, we all end up specializing in something because there's so much to do in this country. So we usually find some kind of niche that we really enjoy. But you are like flowing, shall we say, with the water and finishing a master's degree now. You just wrote a thesis on the water here in Israel. So tell us, what is your background? How did you get into this?
Well, I grew up in the States, and I studied, I studied earth sciences, geology, in Baltimore at the Johns Hopkins University. My last class in Baltimore had to do with water resource development, and it was a subject that I just fell in love with, and I was hooked, and my professor was somebody really famous in Israel. His name was Professor Woolman, and his father, Reds Woolman, is somebody that consulted with the Israelis when they were building the national water carrier in the 50s. So he's kind of a legend also in America and also here. And I just kind of, this subject like fascinated me about how Israel is going to manage its limited quantities of water for the future, and also between not just for itself and its own population, but also with the region, with the Jordanians, the Palestinians, and what the future was going to be. This is the 90s, you know, so there wasn't desalination like there is today. It was a limited pot of water that they were, you know, thinking about dividing up, and, you know, issues with rain and drought, and that pot was getting less and less and less. And what was going to be? It was something that, like, constantly worried me in a way. And I got involved a bit in a research project at the Technion about how Israel was going to manage transboundary resources. And what it did was it looked at 13 different basins around the world, different river basins that were, you know, between countries, shared between countries, lakes, like in Africa, that were shared between countries. And they took lessons. We took lessons that we could learn from the management of those systems, and let's apply it to Israel between the Jordanians and the Palestinians. And that study was actually the basis for the peace negotiations with the Jordanians and with the Palestinians about, you know, giving them the 50 million cubic meters of water the Jordanians. And I was the main researcher in that project, even though I lived in the States. I hooked up with some professors here. And since then, I got married, and we had some kids. We made Aliyah in 2001. And when I got here, I was all gung-ho about, you know, working in the water field and all that. But my Hebrew was not on par with everyone else's Hebrew. You know, I couldn't express my ideas so clearly or do a presentation in Hebrew. So I decided to change track. And, you know, Machon Lander opened up this tour guide course in English. As you know, you're also a student there. So I was in the first class, the first English class, and I got my tour guide license in 2008. And open up a small business. It's called Apricot Tours, www.apricot-tours.com. And a few years later, after developing the business, I realized how much I missed the water issue. And all along, I've been following in the news what's going on, the first desalination plan in 2005, and then, you know, 2007, 2009, as Israel was growing and expanding, developing its desalination. And there was also this biannual conference. It's called the WATEC. Every 2 years, there's a large conference with almost 20,000 people coming to Israel to learn lessons from Israel about how to manage their water, different water technologies, drip irrigation, wastewater treatment. So I was following along the new technologies as well. And I decided, you know, why not open up a niche within tourism where all of these people coming to the WATEC can also stay and do a tour in Israel and visit the actual sites or you know, meet people in academia and develop joint research with Israelis. So I opened up a parallel company, Israel Water Tours. And we've had a few delegations from Arizona. We've had the JNF just had their first water tour, JNF H2O, which I wrote for them. It was in December 2016. And many of you might be familiar with a new book that came out a year ago, Let There Be Water, by Seth M. Siegel. It was also translated into Hebrew, Ma'avak al Kol Tipa, that talks about the whole history of the development of the water resources in Israel, stories of, you know, desalination and different technologies, and how we have this tiny pot, but now the pot has changed where we're actually creating water, so that that pot is actually soon overflowing. We're actually can sell water to our neighbors. We can provide water to our neighbors. We could do lots of things that weren't imaginable 20 years ago. So,
okay, so a little bit of background. Water is a commodity that has always been needed. I mean, if we open the Tanakh, we open the Bible, we realize that the Bible is set in this desert of the Middle East, and a lot of the stories happen near wells, and a lot of the issues and a lot of the ancient civilizations happen near rivers, either the Tigris and Euphrates or the Nile. But here in the land of Israel, we have a relationship with God because 6 months of the year we get no rain and we have no big river. So there's an obsession, there has been an obsession here in Israel with the level of the Kinneret, of our freshwater lake. And as the population here has grown, but there's been a drought for at least the last 20 years all over the Middle East, there's been a real problem with water. So what Israel has done here is risen to the challenge. And I think this is such an Israeli story where we don't have something and therefore we have to figure out how to get it. And so in a region that there's a drought, in a region where many people, many different countries, the people turn on their faucet, they're only going to get water a couple of hours a day. Israel has now not only figured out how to have water security, but as Michelle said, this is something that can turn us into a regional power. If we have a commodity that our neighbors need, doesn't mean that they're going to love us, but they want to give their people water. And so the fact that we can offer them that is also a means of perhaps making some kind of stability here in the region, not friends, again, out of wonderful caring, but just like so many people kowtowed for so long to the Saudis because they had oil and the world wanted oil. So Israel now has water, has fresh water, and in a whole combination of ways, from desalination, from recycling our sewage water. And so we're not so crazy dependent on the level of the Kinneret Lake in the north and how much rain comes down from the sky. So a little bit, Michelle, about where do you see, was there like a, I was going to say like a tipping point, but was a dripping point. Was there a specific thing that happened here where it all kind of clicked in for Israel that we need to do something? I'll give you an example. I'm from California. There's been a drought in California for years. I remember people spray painting their lawns green already for years. Yet it seems that the authorities and the California is not a backward nation. Even till today, they're still not there with where they need to be in terms of providing the people with water. And there's tremendous agriculture in California as well. So what do you think happened here in Israel? Is there a certain person that was a visionary? Was there a certain monetary issue? Was there a war? Was there a combination of all these things where something finally said, whoa, we need to deal with this and we need to have a 10 or 15 year plan and a comprehensive plan on how to make sure that Israel has enough water? Where do you see it? You've done a lot of research. You're an expert on this. How do you see what's happened here in the last couple of decades?
Wow. Okay, that is an interesting question. So a lot of things to talk about. I think, for example, when you look back to the founding of Israel in 1948, I think, for example, Ben-Gurion, he already had a vision that he wanted to develop the Negev. You know, he said, that's the future of Israel. But his biggest worry was, well, where are we going to get the water?
So the Negev is about the southern third of Israel, which is desert. It's part of the world belt of deserts.
Yeah, so it's even more like 50-55% of the land area of Israel. So that was his biggest concern. And that was one of the first large-scale projects that they undertook. I mean, I don't remember the percentage of, you know, they had, you know, a limited amount of money, but a large amount of it went into the, it's called the Yarkon Taninim pipeline, which was a pipeline that they took water from the springs of the Yarkon around Rosh Ayin, and they shipped it down to the Negev so there would be water for the residents. And even the national water carrier was a huge project at the time. It was probably the diameter of the pipe was the biggest one in the world for water, but it was something that, you know, they had the vision, like we have to establish for the future a water network and stability for the residents of the Negev in the future. And that is what started the whole process. But there was many people along the way that were visionaries. That's what makes it so unique in Israel. You know, everybody, a lot of people at the Technion, people in Stable Care at the research facility there at Ben-Gurion, thought of ideas and you know, even the idea of drip irrigation, you know.
Yeah, what's in Israel?
Yeah, it was basically the story of somebody in Kibbutz Hatzerim, which is not far from Be'er Sheva. He was walking in his fields, and he noticed that there was one tree that was much larger than all the others, you know. So he went to investigate, and he, you know, dug a little bit under the ground. He saw the pipe that was bringing the water there, and he saw that there was a hole in that pipe. And that hole in the pipe had caused the tree to grow much larger than the others because the water was dripping into the roots directly and not being, you know, sprayed on the fields, on the surface, and evaporating. There's a large evaporation rate. And that was the idea for drip irrigation.
So it might interest some of our listeners to know also that the water is what got the UN to put the Negev in the partition plan in 1947, when the UN partitions what they call Palestine, the land of Israel here on the west side of the Jordan River. One of the reasons that they end up giving the Negev to the fledgling Jewish state, because in many of the initial plans we were not getting the Negev, is because the Jews of the Yishuv, we're talking about the Jews living here in the pre-state days, had brought water down to the Negev and were irrigating fields. They were already growing banana trees and flowers down in the Negev. And it was the fact that the Jews were able to green the Negev that made that had the UN say, you know what, then we should give the Negev to the Jews. And of course, the great story about that is they had we had brought in 6-inch pipes that had from England that had been left over from the Blitz from World War II. So after 1945, all these 6-inch pipes were kind of stored in England. They didn't know what to do with them. So people from here went there quietly, brought those pipes over here to Israel in 1946, puts them in, and that's why the Negev becomes ours to begin with. So it's not just that we have land and then we have to figure out what to do with it. What we did with the water was even able to change our borders even in the pre-state days. So it's a balancing thing. It's pre and it's post. So you're saying that it's been a process, that it was Ben-Gurion, it was Levi Eshkol, the water carrier, the huge project of the 1950s to bring water from the north and spread it all over the country. So it hasn't been one person or one thing?
That started the process, but a lot of things have happened in the meantime. For example, Israel relies on its groundwater aquifers. Okay, there's the coastal aquifer, which is under the coast from Pachot Yoter Haifa down to Gaza, and there's the Maon aquifer, which is in, you know, Judea and Samaria. And that's the cleanest source for our groundwater that we have. And what was happening was Tel Aviv was growing as a city. There was, you know, lots of agriculture, the oranges, fertilizers, industries were booming, especially the military industry, producing bullets and weapons and things like that. So there was a lot of pollution that happened in the 50s at the beginning of the State of Israel. And that pollution seeped into the groundwater. And so that made the aquifer, the coastal aquifer, very polluted. It made the levels of the aquifer drop due to overpumping because they needed water immediately for its population, its growing population, its agriculture. And so we are still recovering today from the problems of the pollution and the overpumping of the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the reasons why we needed to turn to desalination and develop that industry. And we are the leaders. And you were saying, so there was lots of pieces falling into place. And we are like we're not just a regional power in water. We are a global superpower in water. When you see at these WATEC conferences every 2 years, there'll be one this September, September 12th to the 14th. I recommend people to come even for one day and see the exhibits there that are phenomenal. of Africans and Indians and South Americans coming and coming to see how they can develop their, you know, their water resource, their limited water resources. And America itself, not just California, is going to be suffering in a drought. Huge parts of the Southwest. And, you know, there's other problems like Flint, Michigan issue with the water. So there's issues with, for example, from the pipes, lead from the pipe leaching in. There's lots of different issues in the management of water. And the last conference that was in 2015, there was the governor of California, the governor of Texas, which was Rick Perry at the time. And they were all asking these questions. And there was even local farmers that were there from California and Texas, like, why don't we have wastewater treatment? Why don't we have desalination? Why don't we have drip irrigation? And these are things that take time. You know, the leaders in America, the governmental at the government level, they have to start now so that in 3 years or in 5 years, their constituents will have this technology available to them.
And so I think what happens in politics, we've seen it here in Israel, and I'm sure it's all over the world, is that a sitting government that has a particular budget is going to have to use a good part of that budget for projects that are going to come to completion, not necessarily on his term and not necessarily to give him credit. And so I know it sounds so petty, but that's a lot of times what happens with politics. If you're going to be planning a 10 or 15-year project, chances are you're not going to be sitting in your chair when it comes to fruition. So you're going to spend money now and get people upset with you that you're not giving them what they need for other things today. But you know that for the good of the country or the state, that's what's needed. So you really do need politicians who are thinking bigger than their political career. And unfortunately, all over the world, that's not necessarily what happens. I think that's also tends to be maybe what's happened in America also, is that there isn't those long-term plans are not necessarily put down. You mentioned something that I'm pretty sure most listeners are not aware of, the legalities of water. If a river starts in one country and ends up flowing through a few countries, who owns the water as it's going through? And what happens here in Israel, as in other places, we also have issues of water going underground under borders. So, for example, right now, Judea and Samaria is in a big question mark about who legally controls Judea and Samaria. The rain and the snow that fall in the mountains of Judea and Samaria, much of it flows underground by gravity and ends up near the coast, as Michelle said. So who owns that water? And that was one of the issues that we had when it came to the Oslo Accords. That was one of the big issues in the Oslo Accords of the Palestinian Authority, is they were claiming that the water belongs to them because it starts off in the hills that they were assuming was going to be their future state. And Israel was saying no, when the water finally collects in these aquifers underground, it's under Tel Aviv and under the coast, which is Israel. So, and these are not such simple questions, because when it comes to water, everybody, wars have started over water. Civilizations have fallen apart because of droughts. That's what they think now caused the end of the Bronze Age, the beginning of the Iron Age, and the Mycenaean civilization to fall apart was an enormous drought about 3,000 years ago in the Mediterranean. So this is a huge, huge issue that can really it's a commodity that absolutely can cost lives, not just because people are going to die of dehydration, but because people are going to be upset and want the resources of another country. So how are you seeing all this, again, as one of the experts in the field here in Israel?
Thank you so much. That's a very good comment. You're absolutely right. First of all, I want to point out that the expert, I think, in the mountain aquifer is Professor Chaim Gewertzman from Hebrew University. And he's written a textbook in Hebrew, unfortunately. I've asked him to translate it many times into English for the wider audiences. But what he's pointed out is that in many cases of what we're seeing today, let's, for example, in Syria, in Iran, a lot of the destabilization that's happening in those countries has to do with water issues. For example, Tehran has an issue of a rising water table. So there's actually like water flowing in the streets in Tehran. It's a very unstable situation. In Syria, there was an issue where there was a drought, and many of the farmers had to leave their farms, and they were coming to the cities. and, you know, they didn't have jobs, and there was a lot of unrest, and they believe, some of the geopoliticians believe, that the initial civil war was because of this drought that started, and you had all these people coming to the cities with no work, and so that's a very interesting theory that's going around, and it has, in my opinion, a lot of truth to it.
We had this crazy thing. Do you remember last year, I think it was last September, where the skies for about a week here in Israel were totally full of dust. And it wasn't the time for the usual dust storms coming in from the desert. The meteorologists were trying to figure out what was going on here. I was guiding people at the time. I had to take them inside. You couldn't breathe. It was awful. Yeah. And it turns out that there was all this dust that had been kicked up in Syria and in Iraq because the fields had not been planted and the fields were not green with the things growing there. The fields had all been dusty, and then you have all these war machines and tanks and trucks that are driving across, to the point that they created a huge dust storm that ended up sitting over Israel and Lebanon. So these things don't know borders either. The wind just blew it over here. So there really needs to be regional cooperation in solving the problems here in the Middle East, the huge problems. And what I find so fascinating is that even though politically speaking it seems like Israel is the problem here in the Middle East and everybody doesn't get along with Israel, in this way of water, it could be that we are the solution. And again, not that everyone's going to come and hug us. Let's put that aside for a minute. People still have their religious issues and their territorial issues. But if we can help stabilize the region because we can provide an answer for what is causing a lot of havoc in places very far from here, it could be another angle for really getting this area to calm down. And I know this could be totally wishful thinking, but in an area where nothing much else is working, it could be that our brains, that the fact that we have figured out this technology, that we figured out desalination plants, also that we found natural gas now in the Mediterranean to power our desalination plants and lower the cost of desalinating to something reasonable, could really show, be a light into the nations in the way of showing our neighbors around us and other people around the world what can be done to keep people alive and to keep people fed. It's not just drinking the water, of course, it's also the agriculture that depends on the water.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the title of Seth Siegel's book, the full title, is Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. Mm-hmm. So in his book, that's divided by chapters, which I recommend to everyone, he talks about a technology or something that Israel's done, and he talked about, you know, how it could apply to your country or your region, your area. And, you know, also I want to point out that the tremendous contribution of the Jewish National Fund, the JNF, to Israel, you know, planting, you know, millions of trees, which have prevented this kind of a dust ball effect that's happening. Yeah.
And also reservoirs. They're very big now into creating reservoirs.
Over 200 reservoirs and, you know, a lot in the Negev, places where there wouldn't be water, where they catch the rainwater, you know, the once a year when it rains, they'll catch that water and save it for the summer months when the farmers will need it. But I you know, I want to go back to something you mentioned about the mountain aquifer and even mentioned about Gaza. Gaza is a humanitarian disaster. I mean, already from the 90s when I was a student, I did a report on Gaza and the water situation there. And it's only gotten worse in, you know, 27 years. And the thing is, when the Ashkelon desalination plant was originally built,
that's just to the north of Gaza. It's in Israel. It's Israel's most southern coastal city.
They had in mind that from 110 million cubic meters, it could be expanded, if needed, another 20 million cubic meters, and give some of that water, desalinated water, to Gaza. And they even built a pipeline. Not many people know about this. They built a pipeline. Shimon Tal was the water commissioner at the time. He told me this story. They built a pipeline to something like 100 meters of the border with Gaza. 100 meters. All the people of Gaza have to do, the government at the highest level, is to connect 100 meters of pipe to this pipeline, and they will get desalinated water from the Ashkelon desalination plant. Now, it's a question of political will. It's in my opinion, they have only to benefit from doing that and increasing regional cooperation. But in a way, unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority benefits from having their people, in not a good situation. It benefits them politically, by keeping them without electricity, without water, it ferments the unrest there.
Right. And so that and Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas now completely. I was just reading a couple of days ago that some of their sewage is now spilling into the Absolutely. Mediterranean because their central authority cares more about building tunnels and trying to attack Israel than actually making their people's lives good. So they've got sewage spilling into the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean flows in a counterclockwise direction. It means any sewage that spills off the coast of Gaza ends up flowing up the coast of Israel. So the desalination plant just to the north of Gaza is meant to take salt out of water, not poop, if you'll excuse me, not sewage. And therefore, their putting sewage in the water can also corrupt Israel's desalination. Now, it would be nice to think that that would upset them, but in an authority that's trying to undermine Israel and hurt Israel any way it can, it could be that sewage going into the water and hurting Israel is incentive and not deterrence for that. So we're dealing in this situation here, and Michelle so rightly brings that up, that we're not dealing with rational governments around us that not necessarily want to help their people. Those countries like Jordan, we can deal with and help. But when you're dealing with really unbalanced regimes who just want to make life terrible for everybody, then even the what we want to give to people and the knowledge and the advancement and to better their lives not necessarily is not going to be appreciated, but it might even be wrecked. And so we definitely have to put that into the equation. Things here don't go by what makes sense to us all the time. There are different proclivities, shall we say, here in the Middle East.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I visit many times with my delegations, the Ashkelon plant, and many times we get there and it's not running and we say, what's going on? And they say, well, there was sewage off the coast of Gaza and we cannot, our intake pipe sucks that water in and we cannot, we have to wait till this, goes out to sea and then we can start pumping again. So in a way, it's a type of environmental conflict, environmental warfare. And the same thing happens in the mountain aquifer. You were just saying how, the Palestinians claim the water and we also claim the water. Well, the mountain aquifer is a bit complicated in that there's actually divided into three areas. And what we see is it's not like the aquifer over the coast where it's, very shallow, 10 meters down. The water in the mountain aquifer sometimes could be a mile down, and it's very expensive to pump that water up. So so what happens is in the sources of those areas, which is, let's say, over Nablus, over the main cities, the Palestinian cities, you have pollution because they don't have a wastewater treatment, or you have the agricultural pollution from use of fertilizer. And that pollution is seeping down into 1 mile deep aquifer. Okay, and like you said, and then it comes out to the west around Petah Tikva, where we actually do pump the aquifer out, where it's much more shallow around Petah Tikva. It's called the Arkon Taninim area. So when we pump it out there, we are getting the pollution right from the Palestinian areas. And this is a very serious problem that, many people have tried to tackle. And it's an issue. It's a joint management issue. Until they have the will to build wastewater treatment in their areas, and the Americans have given the money after Oslo, the Germans, the Japanese, they've given the money to allocate for these plants. But the political will is such that they do not want to have, they would want this pollution to continue to flow.
Right. Or their leadership takes the money that's given by the world trying to do good for the people and just takes it for themselves. And I remember a couple of years ago, the Be'er Sheva River sources out of Hebron, and I remember they had an issue with polio, I think. In Hebron, they were throwing the polio vaccines into the river, and it was ending up in Be'er Sheva and causing a problem in Be'er Sheva. When it comes to environmental issues, unless there is that cooperation, as Michelle said, things aren't going to work, which is another reason that, as my listeners know, I personally think that Israel should be the complete sovereign, also over Judea and Samaria, not just in terms of the ideology and the history and the religious, et cetera, but for the environmental good of everybody in these areas. You need one authority that is going to make sure that everybody has clean water, that sewage isn't flowing where it's not supposed to flow, and that you don't have these kinds of political games that are being played, which end up to the detriment of the little people. We can't afford to do that. And that is a very big issue that I think a lot of people miss in all the other stuff, that all the other chatter that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, something that I've read, I think in 1948, the villages in the West Bank, something like 10% were connected to the water system. Mm-hmm. Today, it's almost 95% of the Palestinian villages are all connected to the Israeli infrastructure, the water infrastructure, like something they don't talk about. But we've created for them, you know, an oasis. You know, when you look at what's going on in Lebanon, in Syria, and in, you know, in Iraq, and it's really literally an oasis here. You drive around the country, and we are flourishing, you know. It's amazing.
I hear that from tourists all the time as they're flying over Israel before they land at Ben-Gurion, and I'll meet them, and they'll say, well, one of the things that we saw from the air that we didn't expect is how green it is. But it's not green because we have rainfall. It's not green because we waste the water. It's green because we recycle our water. So for agriculture, over 90% is recycled water. We desalinate, and we're careful. We really are careful. We don't have sprinklers going in the middle of the day. I've got a bucket in my shower, and that first, you know, water before it gets warm goes into the geraniums on my porch. And I think a lot of Israelis are like that. When you don't have a lot, then you don't waste it. I think to a great degree, that's you don't see too much waste. You don't see too many people hosing down their sidewalk in front of their house, do you?
I mean, you do see some waste because now you have the opposite problem. Because, you know, you ask people, they say, yeah, we have desalination. We don't have a problem, you know. But, you know, it's also just in general the way we are. We care about our land. We're connected to our land. We want to preserve our land. We want to preserve our water resources. And you don't see that same, you know, consciousness, you know, with our neighbors necessarily. You know, and you see, actually, you see there is a bit of a growing movement among students, among women, like really? Women empowerment among the Palestinians. A lot of the projects, a lot of the women empowerment are involved in agricultural projects, water projects. I've met them at different conferences. EcoPeace is a big, organization where they help within Jordanians and Palestinians. They want to do now the Lower Jordan Rehabilitation Project, which will also include villages, Palestinian villages in the Jordan Valley, Jordanians.
Right.
So some of these regional projects we talked about.
Do you have an opinion on the Red Dead Canal? That's been talked about for a few years. For those of you who are not familiar with the map here in Israel, so if you look at the very bottom of the Negev, that little dot, a lot, which is the Red Sea. So it's been talked about for a few years now also to rehabilitate the Dead Sea, which is, while it's not a source of fresh water, it's a very, very salty lake. But one of the ideas is, in order to keep it from shrinking too much, is to bring in water from the Red Sea and pipe it up through the Arava and have it go out in the Dead Sea. It would also create electricity along the way and help rehabilitate the Dead Sea. And of course, we could desalinate perhaps and get some water along the way. But it's very controversial because nobody really knows what's going to happen when seawater hits the Dead Sea water and if everything's going to end up smelling like sulfur or I don't know. We're not really sure about the environmental issues. Also cooperation with Jordan, also the expense. Has that been part of your research? What's your opinion on the Red Dead Canal?
It's great that you brought this up. You're not going to like my opinion. Okay, my opinion is I'm actually against the Red Dead Canal. I'm against it because I feel that it will impact badly to the Dead Sea.
I happen to agree with you, by the way.
Okay.
Yes. I'm nowhere near the expert you are, but from everything that I've read, too many question marks
here.
Too many question marks.
Yeah. The density of the Dead Sea water is the lowest point on Earth. It has, you know, more than 10 or 15 minerals. It's very dense water, whereas, you know, seawater in general is dense. But the Red Sea water, when you pipe it and you put it into the Dead Sea, you could get something called stratification, where you have one layer of the Red Sea that's sitting on one layer of the Dead Sea water, which is denser. Now, they've done pilot studies, and I was at this forum where people presented the results of the pilot study and, you know, people, it was like an open forum where people can air their complaints to the plan and such and such. Now, the person that did the pilot study, he said there's absolutely no problem if you will pipe the water in at a certain point, you know, minus 400, and you pipe it underneath, then mm-hmm. there's no choice for the water to absolutely mix. You know, but I'm not so sure. I'm a little bit skeptical. And there's another issue about the Red Dead Canal. There's other plans in the past. The Red Dead Canal is not a new plan. It's something from the 20s. There's many plans. And another idea that people have had, and it's actually coming back within the private industry, is the Med Dead Canal could be a better option. Because the Red Dead Canal, you're talking about piping, building 210-kilometer long pipeline, you know? And now to make it a regional project and to make the World Bank be want to be the funders, they had to make it a regional project. So it's been decided that the pipeline will be primarily in Jordan. Okay, so basically it's a Jordanian project. You know, it's a feel-good project. And Jordan is even worse shape for water than we are. You know, much worse. So for them, they're desperate for the water that's going to come to the Dead Sea, that's going to be piped to the Dead Sea. The elevation difference is going to cause, they're going to create a hydroelectric plant, which is going to desalinate water. And that water is going to go to Jordan. It's not going to go to Israel. The only benefit Israel is going to get potentially from this project is regional cooperation and raising the level of the Dead Sea 1 meter per year, something like that. Mm-hmm. So slowly, the water is no longer, the Dead Sea will no longer be sinking. It'll be stabilized. Mm-hmm. And potentially in 20 years, it will start rising again. That's the main benefits that Israel will get.
Do you think the dangers of not knowing what's going to happen to the environment outweigh the benefits for Israel at this point anyway? That the Med Dead Canal, which is, 45 miles from the Mediterranean down to the Dead Sea, and with a huge drop, I know, because at the time it had been talked about doing it in my area of Gush Etzion, which is about 900 meters above sea level. It's a drop of 1,300 meters, which would create a lot of electricity as well. You think that's more viable, plus it's more within Israel's hands, within Israeli control? Another reason, perhaps, for Israel putting sovereignty on Judean Samaria is being able to control that section?
Instead of 210 kilometers, it's something like, I don't remember exactly, but something like 75 to 100 kilometers from Gaza to the Dead Sea, you know, and, you know, there will be more benefits for the northern Negev because it will be within Israel control. It will be, you know, who's building the pipeline and who's building the canals. It will be Israelis versus Jordanians. So, you know, so it's a, you know, I cannot say. I mean, I know the person that recommended the plan to Bibi. His name is Doron Merkel. He's also in charge of the Kinneret. He works for the Israel Water Authority. He's gung-ho about this plan, and many people are gung-ho about this plan. But, you know, it's a plan that we have to proceed, if we proceed with it, cautiously, you know.
It's also not a new plan. I know that Yuval Ne'aman, who was once the science minister, was a physicist. He proposed this plan like 30 years ago, and I think it was voted down by one vote, again, because of some of the political issues. So this is something that's floating up again, right?
No, but it's actually moving along. They did a pilot study. The World Bank did a pilot study, and they've allocated, you know, something like $300 million. Wow. You know, the whole project itself is slated to be $10 billion. Wow. $10 billion. It's like, you know, it's a mega project that's going to benefit, you know, the Jordanians mainly and Israel, the kibbutzim in the Arava, okay, and which are not connected to the national water carrier, and potentially the Palestinians that are the third partner in the scheme. So in my opinion, any... You know, water is a mechanism to foster peace and relations, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it may not necessarily be, you know, that the Red Dead Canal is it. There's lots of little projects that are going on all the time, cooperation, Jordanian scientists, Palestinian scientists and researchers. You know, that these are not talked about, but they are known. That water could be the main vehicle for peace for us in the future because everyone is dependent on it and everybody needs it for survival, you know. So,
all right, so it's starting to get noisy in here, so I think we're going to have to wrap this up. But it's an important point to remember that we don't have to have big agreements. We can just try and make people's lives better on the ground or under the ground, and water can definitely be a vehicle for that. And also having enough water can prevent a worst-case scenario. And so all of these things are really very important to remember. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me today, and I would love to interview you again. And if anybody wants to be in touch with her, you can write to her at Israel Water Tours at www.israelwatertours.com. For you, maybe, do you share your report? Do you share your thesis or some of the conclusions that you've come to? Or
Not quite yet. It's too new.
It's just hot off the press.
Yeah.
Okay, but at some point we will. And it's just wonderful that we have just among us here in Israel another tour guide who really knows her stuff when it comes to the water. And I'm definitely going to use her as a resource as well. So thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is Windows of Jerusalem Apartments. Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments offers luxury 5-star short and long-term rental apartments in the heart of Jerusalem city center. Elegant and modern, inviting and comfortable. The view, the location, the great apartments, and the staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com. That's windowsofjerusalem.com.